Hey, this is Dave DeCamp from AntiWar.com. This is Anti-War News for Friday, March 24th, 2023. All right, so some big news just broke right after I recorded the episode, so I'm just putting this in the front here. The U.S. launched airstrikes in Syria after a drone attack killed a U.S. contractor. So the Pentagon announced this on Thursday night around 11 p.m. that it launched airstrikes in Syria after a drone attack killed a U.S. contractor and wounded five U.S. troops near Hasaka in northeast Syria. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin said that at the direction of President Biden, he authorized, quote, U.S. Central Command forces to conduct precision airstrikes tonight in eastern Syria against facilities used by groups affiliated with Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, it's the IRGC, end quote. So the groups that the U.S. targeted were likely Shia militias that operate in Syria. When they say that they're affiliated with the IRGC, they're Iran-backed, that's who they mean. There's Iraqi militias that operate there. There's Afghan Shia militias that operate there. There's a lot of these different militias. And the Pentagon claimed that the U.S. intelligence determined that the drone was of Iranian origin. But at this point, you know, there's no indication that Iran was involved in this attack. But that does seem who the U.S. is trying to blame here for this. We know we can't take the Pentagon's word for anything. The Pentagon said that the two of the wounded U.S. troops were treated on site, and three additional service members and the U.S. contractor were medically evacuated to coalition medical facilities in Iraq. So again, the contractor died and five troops were wounded, but it looks like they're recovering. The U.S., so, you know, as we know, there's about 900 troops stationed in eastern Syria, and these U.S. bases, they frequently come under attack. And President Biden has previously launched airstrikes against these Shia militias in both Iraq, in Syria and Iraq. And the last major escalation took place in August 2022 when Biden ordered a series of airstrikes. And he did that in response to an attack on a U.S. base that caused no casualties. So this is just always a risk. This shows that the U.S. occupation of eastern Syria that is opposed by the Syrian government, it always risks sparking a wider war. And again, there's very little detail about this. So hopefully, you know, this doesn't escalate further, but it's always a risk. And it's just a big part of the reason why the U.S. has just got to get out of there. Putting these troops in harm's way for no reason other than to, you know, occupy oil fields and keep that resource out of the hands of Damascus. It's part of this economic campaign against the country of Syria. It has nothing to do with ISIS. They don't care about that. That's what this is about. And it needs to end because things like this are going to keep happening. You know, this could always escalate again into a major war. You never know what could happen here. Russia's in Syria. Iran's in Syria. Who knows? But anyway, that's it for this story. Now here is the rest of the show that I recorded before this news broke. All right, the first story at the top of antiwar.com today. The Pentagon says that its new budget will prepare for war with China. So Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, told Congress at a Thursday hearing that the Pentagon's 2024 budget request will help the country prepare for a future war with China. So Milley, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he's America's highest ranking military officer. He insisted that the Pentagon's massive $842 billion budget request is meant to deter a war, but said that it would also prepare the U.S. military to fight one. He told the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense that deterring and preparing for a conflict, quote, is extraordinarily expensive, but it's not as expensive as fighting a war. And this budget prevents war and prepares us to fight it if necessary, end quote. So the Pentagon has identified China as, this is from the 2022 National Defense Strategy, which named China the most comprehensive and serious challenge to U.S. national security. And lately, we've seen and heard a lot more U.S. military leaders speaking more explicitly about how they're preparing for a direct war with China, despite the risk of nuclear war. They're not talking about this as if, you know, we would be supporting a proxy war against China. They're talking about direct combat with, you know, Chinese forces over in the Asia Pacific. And President Biden has said this as well. He said that he would defend Taiwan in the event of a Chinese attack. And he said that includes deploying American men and women, deploying troops to go fight over there. So Milley said something interesting. He said China's actions, quote, are moving it down the path toward confrontation and potential conflict with its neighbors and possibly the United States, end quote. That sounded very similar to a warning that the Chinese foreign minister, Qin Gang, gave earlier this month. He said that if the U.S. doesn't change course on its military buildup in the Asia Pacific and other policies aimed at China, including Taiwan, increasing support for Taiwan, he said it would lead to conflict and confrontation. And the U.S. has shown no sign that it's going to back down on this military buildup, and the Pentagon's budget request will further expand the U.S. military footprint in the region by funding a buildup plan known as the Pacific Deterrence Initiative. So Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense, he said at this hearing, quote, this budget includes a 40% increase over last year's for the Pacific Deterrence Initiative to an all-time high of $9.1 billion. That will fund a stronger force posture, better defenses for Hawaii and Guam, and deeper cooperation with our allies and allied partners, end quote. And that's a huge part of the U.S. strategy is building these alliances, you know, the Quad, AUKUS, encouraging Japan to double its military spending, sending more assets to the Korean Peninsula, expanding bases in the Philippines. This is all about this buildup against China. But, you know, despite all this, for the hawks in Congress, what the Pentagon has asked for is not enough. Their budget request isn't enough. So Biden's full military spending budget request for 2024 totals $886.4 billion. And Congress is expected to add tens of billions of more to that, as they did the previous 2 years when Biden made the request. They just give him a bunch more. So, I mean, that's just the situation we're in. These are the people we're dealing with. And I think it's important to highlight, I know I do this a lot, just the fact that U.S. military leaders, they're talking about how they're preparing for war with China, which would just be catastrophic for the entire world. And, you know, all these things they're doing in the name of deterrence from Beijing's view, you know, it's provocation. All right, the next one here. The U.S. sails a warship near Chinese-controlled islands in the South China Sea. So this was on Thursday, and they sailed this ship near the Paracel Islands in the South China Sea amid heightened tensions between Washington and Beijing in the region. China's People's Liberation Army said that it drove away the guided missile destroyer USS Milius after they said it illegally sailed near the disputed islands. The U.S. Navy's 7th Fleet disputed China's claims and said that the ship was not expelled. And this usually happens when the U.S. does these maneuvers by these Chinese-controlled islands. China says, yeah, we told them, and they left, and the U.S. says, no, we were just doing our thing and left when we decided to. So the U.S. does not recognize most of China's claims to the South China Sea and began challenging them during the Obama administration by sending warships near Chinese-controlled islands, maneuvers that they call freedom of navigation operations. So if you're watching the video here, the Paracel Islands are in the northern area of the South China Sea, close to Hainan, which is China. And that's where this U.S. warship was sailing around. Usually they sail within 12 nautical miles of these islands. That's what's considered a country's territorial waters. So they do that to challenge the idea that this is Chinese territory. And if you see this map here, you just see China and several Southeast Asian nations have overlapping claims to the South China Sea. Taiwan claims the same waters that China does, what they call the nine-dash line, which is most of the sea. Vietnam also has very expansive claims. And then they're all overlapping. The Philippines, Vietnam overlap. So that's the situation there. And so the Paracel Islands, where the U.S. sailed the ship nearby, that's claimed by China, Taiwan, and Vietnam, and it's controlled by China. So this dispute has become a major source of tensions between the U.S. and China, as Washington has become involved in the dispute and has increased its military activity in the South China Sea in recent years. The U.S. has really ramped up surveillance flights, sending warships there, sending aircraft carriers for drills. And the U.S. also backs the Philippines' claims against China and has been deepening military cooperation with Manila. And they signed that deal last month that will give the U.S. military access to four more bases in the Philippines, including one in Palawan, which is a Philippine province facing the South China Sea. That is this slender island here. It's very close to waters that China claims. So the U.S. is going to have a military base there. And China is very against this U.S. military expansion in the Philippines, of course, and they've made that known to the Philippines. They just held some talks with them about it. And what they're really not happy about is the fact that apparently the other bases that the U.S. is going to get access to is in the north, which is facing Taiwan. So I think that's what China is really not happy with. All right, the next one here, this is from Middle East Eye, and it says that the U.S. will send old tank-busting planes to the Middle East, advanced jets to Asia and Europe. So the U.S. plans to deploy aging A-10 attack planes to the Middle East in order to send more advanced combat aircraft to Asia as part of a pivot away from the region to focus on the great power rivalries with China and Russia. The move, reported by the Wall Street Journal on Thursday, comes as the Pentagon is looking to scale back its Middle East footprint. Earlier this month, U.S. Air Force officials proposed a 2024 budget of $7 billion for operations in the Middle East and Southwest Asia, about $1.6 billion less than last year. So the proposal comes as the Air Force is increasing its overall spending. So it's basically another example of how they are focusing on China. And this is a quote from Frank Kendall. He's a U.S. Air Force secretary, and he speaks very bluntly about what his priorities are. He said in a statement, quote, "We are united in our commitment to modernizing the air and space forces and in achieving the transformation we must have to be competitive with our pacing challenge, China, China, China," end quote. This is about the U.S. scaling back from the Middle East and to focus more on China and Russia, but mainly China seems to be the focus. Although, of course, the U.S. has really built up in Eastern Europe since around the time Russia invaded Ukraine. So that's obviously a priority for them, too. But, you know, long term, it's all about China. All right. The next one here, Zelensky tells Europe, give me more weapons and add sanctions on Russia. So Zelensky said this on Thursday. He demanded that European countries provide more military aid and add more sanctions on Russia, warning that not doing so would prolong the war. So he said this in a virtual address to EU leaders. He said they should provide longer-range weapons and Western-made fighter jets. He thanked Slovakia and Poland for providing Soviet-made MiG-29 planes, but said Kiev needs modern aircraft. He said, quote, "Is there rational motivation for the protraction in providing modern aircraft?" End quote. He dismissed concerns about Russia potentially escalating the war in response to such support, pointing to the provision of German-made Leopard tanks. Zelensky said, quote, "Remember how many Russian threats there were when it came to the transfer of Leopards and other tanks, more advanced than those our soldiers had previously? These were more advanced tanks. These more advanced tanks are already in Ukraine. So what did Russia do in response? We all have to get used to the fact that a terrorist state bluffs more often than it can escalate," end quote. So saying Putin is bluffing, they're all bluffing. And, you know, we see talking points like this from hawks in Washington that say, you know, give Ukraine everything they want. Putin's not going to do anything, even though at the same time they say he's this madman bent on, you know, world domination. So Zelensky really sharpened his rhetoric when discussing sanctions, and he criticized the EU for not adding more. Zelensky said, quote, "The protraction with new European sanctions packages is becoming increasingly troublesome," end quote. He said that efforts to prevent Russia from circumventing sanctions are not yet sufficient, and he said other countries will think that they can ignore sanctions. He said, quote, "That's why sanctions must be expanded. There cannot be even a slight hint of delaying decisions on sanctions," end quote. So again, very demanding, which is typical of him. And he also said that there must be no easing of sanctions, especially in the name of food security. He's saying that's all the concerns about Russian and Belarusian fertilizer and grain shipments. That's all nonsense. You know, add sanctions. And we'll get more into that into the next story. But Zelensky concluded his frustrated address by claiming if Europe doesn't act quickly enough, quote, "evil may have time to regroup and prepare itself for years of war," end quote. So the next one, this is from Kyle Anzalone and Connor Freeman at the Libertarian Institute. The UN has a plan to curb world hunger, but the EU won't lift sanctions. So Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, he is attempting to persuade the European Union to lift sanctions on the Belarusian fertilizer industry, but is making little progress, according to Politico. The UN believes that removing the export restrictions will help get more agricultural products to Africa. However, the EU claims that the sanctions are key to applying pressure on Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko. Gutierrez traveled to Brussels on Thursday in an effort to secure an agreement with European diplomats to lift sanctions on Belarus's fertilizer. So they have imposed sanctions specifically on Belarusian fertilizer in 2021. This was a couple years ago when they started increasing sanctions on Belarus following the 2020 election. They rejected the results and started sanctioning them. And then 2021, Belarus landed a plane to arrest somebody or something. And then the EU added these sanctions. And the country most responsible for keeping the sanctions imposed is Lithuania. So it's Lithuania, and they have the support of the other Baltic states and Poland. And this is a common theme in the EU. The Baltic states and Poland are very hawkish when it comes to Russia and Belarus, and they don't want to bend and, you know, give any sort of sanctions relief. Brazil and West African countries are some of the nations which depend most on Belarus for fertilizer. One European diplomat says the countries have used methods to serve. So they're saying that they're circumventing these sanctions. Prior to being blacklisted, Belarus accounted for 20% of the global potash supply, which is a type of fertilizer. So they just don't want to listen to the UN about this and are keeping these sanctions on. And then there's also the issue of the Russian grain and fertilizer. Russia's not happy with the West's efforts to facilitate those shipments. And they're threatening to scrap the grain deal that they just extended. Russia's saying it's only extended for 2 months, and that if these things aren't worked out, then the deal is done. So we'll see how that all plays out. All right, the next one here, the World Bank says that Ukraine's reconstruction will cost at least $411 billion. So the World Bank said in a new report that Ukraine's reconstruction will cost at least $411 billion over the next 10 years, a number that will rise as the war drags on. So the report said that the $411 billion figure should be seen as a minimum, as needs will continue to rise as long as the war continues. So the World Bank's vice president, Anna Berge, she previously estimated that the reconstruction, she gave it a higher estimate back in December. She said it was between about 500 and 600 billion, but this report issued on Wednesday was more precise, and it was produced jointly with the US and Ukrainian governments. So now she is saying that the Ukrainian reconstruction will take several years, and it will require public investments complemented by private investments. And we know American investment firms and banks, specifically BlackRock and JP Morgan, are looking to cash in on this reconstruction project. Bankers from JP Morgan Chase were recently in Ukraine. They signed a memorandum of understanding with President Zelensky and agreed to help raise private capital for a new fund for Ukraine's reconstruction. And back in January, Zelensky addressed the U.S. National Association of State Chambers and said that American corporations would find big business in rebuilding Ukraine. He said, quote, "Everyone can become a big business by working with Ukraine. in all sectors, from weapons and defense to construction, from communications to agriculture, from transport to IT, from banks to medicine, end quote. So there's going to be a lot of money to be made in, you know, rebuilding Ukraine. The new estimate from the World Bank comes as there is no sign that the fighting in Ukraine will end anytime soon. Unfortunately, that seems to be the reality of the situation. China did recently launch their peace initiative, but it's not clear if it's going to lead to any real negotiations. All right. The next one here, this is interesting. AFRICOM says that coup leaders share core values. So General Michael Langley, who is the head of U.S. Africa Command, was grilled on Thursday by Matt Gaetz, a Republican representative from Florida. And he was grilled about African soldiers who received U.S. military training and went on to carry out coups. This is a recurring thing that happens. Langley insisted that only a very small number of Africans who receive U.S. training later go on to be involved in coups against civilian governments, and said that the programs focus on core values. So then Gaetz asked, does the U.S. share core values with Guinea coup leader Colonel Mamadi Doumbouya? And Langley replied, quote, absolutely, in our curriculum, we do, end quote. So I'll just play a little bit of this clip. It's kind of long, but you could see it seems like he was not expected to be grilled on this issue, and Gaetz kind of tripped him up. But he said absolutely when he was asked if, you know, we share core values with this colonel who carried out a coup in Guinea in 2021. And at the time, U.S. Green Berets were in the country training him and his forces, and then they went off and carried out a coup. So I'll just play a little bit from this.
General Langley, I have constituents that have
been good.
Colonel Mamadi Doumbouya. That's him with a bunch of U.S. service members outside of our embassy. And just months after this photo was taken in 2021, he led a coup in Guinea and threw out the leader. Does that concern you?
Congressman, core values is what we start off with in IMA programs.
Do we share core values with Colonel Doumbouya?
Core values. I will repeat that. Core values, respect for humanity.
Do we share those values with Colonel?
Absolutely, in our curriculum.
He led a coup.
We do.
Okay, well, that's a very telling answer. In Burkina Faso, did we share core values with the leader that we trained there who led a coup?
It's in our curriculum. We leading stress coups. Core.
All right, so that kind of goes on, and then Gaetz asks, "It's in the curriculum to lead coups?" And he said, "No." He insisted, you know, the core values he's talking about is democracy and civilian-led governments. But just, you know, on the background of this, so Gaetz also referenced the coup in Burkina Faso in January 2022. That was led by a guy named Lieutenant Colonel Paul Henri Sandiago Damib. I might have butchered his name, but he had a long history of participating in U.S. training exercises. So later that year, in September 2022, he was ousted in another coup led by Captain Ibrahim Traore. And Nick Terse, who's a journalist who writes for The Intercept, Responsible Statecraft, he's kind of the authority on AFRICOM and U.S. Special Ops in Africa. He asked the Pentagon if this guy who led the second coup also received U.S. training, and the Pentagon said it wasn't sure. So Terse said, you know, in this article that he wrote about this last year, he said that since 2008, U.S. trained soldiers in Africa have attempted at least 9 coups and succeeded in at least 8 across five West African countries. So it's a pretty serious pattern there. And I think it's good to see Gaetz, grilling the head of AFRICOM about this. And this isn't some low level guy. This is, you know, the commander of U.S. Africa Command, and they have a lot going on in Africa. I always talk about the airstrikes in Somalia, but there's a ton of special ops and, of course, all this training, and it's so shrouded in secrecy. There's so few journalists that are really digging into this, like Terse is. So I think it's good to, you know, see them get uncomfortable when they have to talk about this stuff. So again, Langley insisted that these core values were focused on respect for civilian governance, and Gaetz said that those values are not sticking. Gaetz said, quote, just a moment ago, you said we shared core values with Colonel Doumbouya. You said that just moments ago in response to my question, and his core value seems to be leading a coup. So I don't think it has stuck. I think we should at least know how many countries we train the coup plotters, end quote. So asking, I guess he's asking for more transparency when it comes to these operations. All right, the next one here, the Senate votes down Senator Rand Paul's resolution to repeal the 2001 AUMF. So this was on Wednesday, and the Senate voted down this amendment that was introduced by Rand Paul, and it would have repealed the 2001 Authorization for the Use of Military Force, the AUMF. That was passed in the wake of the September 11th attacks to invade Afghanistan and is still used to justify wars today. The bill did not come close to passing and failed in a vote of 9-86, with only 4 Republicans, 4 Democrats, and 1 independent, that being Bernie Sanders, supporting the legislation. The vote came ahead of the Senate voting on a repeal of the 1991 and 2002 Iraq AUMFs, but that's just repealing those is just a symbolic move because those authorizations are not used to wage war today. So Paul said in a statement after the 2001 AUMF vote, quote, "Today I offered the U.S. Senate a chance to repeal the 9/11/2001 authorization for war, to reclaim our constitutional power, and send a message to the world that we are a nation of peace. Today we should have risen above symbolism and repealed the 9/11 authorization for war and shown our respect for the Constitution, our fealty to the rule of law, and our sincere desire that peace, not perpetual war, be our legacy," end quote. So the 2001 AUMF right now is being used to justify the U.S. occupation of Syria, U.S. operations in Iraq, the war against al-Shabaab in Somalia, and other special operations across Africa. And most of these groups, all the ones I just mentioned at least, didn't exist when the authorization became law, but that's still what they're using. And repealing the 91 and 2002 AUMFs, the 91 is the Gulf War, 2002 was for the 2003 invasion, that's not going to have any impact on U.S. operations in the Middle East and Africa. And President Biden previously claimed Article 2 of the Constitution as his authority to justify airstrikes against Shia militias in Iraq and Syria, which is just wild to me. So it does seem like they can use whatever they want to justify war, but at the same time, the presence in Iraq and Syria is justified with the 2001 AUMF. So get rid of that. Could they still keep this presence? And then during a debate in the Senate, Senator Tim Kaine, a Democrat from Virginia, he basically argued, yeah, we could repeal the 91 and 2002 because it's not going to make a difference. He said that Biden has the Article 2 power to defend against Iranian-backed militias in Iraq, and he said that Biden is doing it every day. So this whole polling, repealing these AUMFs that they're repealing, because it does seem like that's going to happen. It's really just symbolic. It's kind of nonsense, just a distraction to act like they're doing something to rein in presidential war, you know, powers when really they're not. So I just thought that was important to point out. And then I put the video in of Rand Paul's speech on the floor before they voted on his amendment, which was pretty good stuff. All right. I left up the one from Seymour Hersh yesterday, you know, about the CIA planting the Nord Stream cover-up story, because that's really something. The next one here could be very big news. According to a report from Reuters, Saudi Arabia and Syria have agreed to establish ties and reopen their embassies after over a decade of not having formal diplomatic relations. So unnamed sources told Reuters that contacts between Riyadh and Damascus gained momentum following the surprise Saudi-Iran normalization deal that was brokered by China. And of course, Tehran is a major ally of the Syrian government of President Bashar al-Assad. So Saudi Arabia severed diplomatic relations with Syria in 2011 and threw its support behind the failed U.S.-backed regime change effort. And as it's become clear that Assad isn't going anywhere, more regional countries have been normalizing with his government. And this effort has really been led by the UAE, which reopened its embassy in Syria in 2018. So one source told Reuters that Syria and Saudi Arabia are preparing to reopen embassies after Eid al-Fitr, which is a Muslim holiday that will be celebrated this year on April 21st and April 22nd. So it's about a month away. And of course, the U.S. is against any normalization steps between Syria and regional countries, as it occupies about one third of Syrian territory and maintains crippling economic sanctions on the country. The Biden administration has even come out against the country's upgrading ties with Assad as part of an effort to help Syria recover from a devastating earthquake that hit on February 6th and killed thousands of Syrians. So I don't think this is a done deal, but I think it sounds like, this could happen. And this would be another huge shift in the region, normalization deal that the U.S. wouldn't have any part of, because, of course, they're against all this. So if it's Iran, Saudi, they had to pretend like they were happy about that. And now this is something that I think they're really not going to be happy about. So it just shows the Saudis are kind of just bucking the U.S. and doing their own thing. But this is good because, the more countries normalize with Syria, the more likely it is that the U.S. will have to pull out of there. We'll have to, especially if Turkey would be huge. If Turkey and Assad normalize, that might really push the U.S. out. All right. The last story here, speaking of Turkey, their parliament committee okayed the Finland NATO membership. So the Turkish Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee has approved a bill that would ratify Finland's NATO membership after Erdogan, the Turkish president, said that his country would approve bringing Finland into the alliance without Sweden. So Turkey's parliament, this is just a committee, their parliament known as the Grand National Assembly. They still need to approve the bill, and the ratification is expected to happen before Turkey's May 14th presidential election. So Turkey and Hungary are the only two NATO members that have yet to approve Finland and Sweden's NATO bids. Hungarian leaders say that they will ratify their memberships, and Hungary's parliament is scheduled to vote on the issue on March 27th, but it has delayed the debate several times before. Also on Thursday, Finland's president signed a law that will allow the country to join the Western Military Alliance. They added the necessary amendments. So now they just need to wait until Turkey and Hungary ratify their membership. Finland initially began its NATO bid vowing that it would not join the alliance without their friends in Sweden. But after Erdogan said Sweden has not done enough to join NATO and signaled that he would approve Helsinki alone, Finnish officials have abandoned that position. And bringing Finland into NATO will significantly raise tensions with Moscow, as Finland and Russia share an over 800-mile border. It's a huge border. It's going to double NATO territory that borders Russia. And this region now is destined to become further militarized. Russia's military is planning to expand its presence in the region. And I know Finland is working on beefing up their border there. So that's the direction we're headed. But that's it for the news for today. And you could go check out our viewpoints. We have one from Joe Plenzier. The first casualty of war is truth. Iraq 20 years later. That's over at military.com. And it's interesting, these days you could see honest assessments of the Iraq war, in mainstream media outlets. But a lot of people still haven't apologized for their coverage of it back then. One from Jude Russo, the 8-year-old Iraq. This is from the American Conservative. Jonathan Cook, the BBC Nakba series obscures ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And one from Obama bin Javid, Abu Ghraib survivor taking the hood off. This is over at Al Jazeera. And he talks about his time in, the notorious torture prison that the U.S. had in Iraq. So go check that out. And our spotlight is from Ted Snyder, what AUKUS sub ruckus means for regional security. That's everything. That's it for the week. You could always support us at antiwar.com/donate. Like and subscribe to the show on YouTube. Share it around, comment, all that stuff. I appreciate everything. But that's it for me. I'll talk to you after the weekend. Thanks for listening.